All right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lee Haffrey. I'm the moderator for this morning's panel on business and responsible leadership ethics after Enron on behalf of the Aspen Institute and all of its sponsors, of whom several are represented here this morning. I'm delighted to see you all here for this conversation. We have an hour and a half a time to talk with our five panelists. Four of them are in the program. We added a fifth. Our panelists for today, and I'm going to do this alphabetically, Paul Anderson from Booz Allen, Beth Brook from Ernst & Young, David Greenberg from Altria, Sydney Harmon from Harmon International, and Jonathan Oppenheimer from De Beers. We're going to be talking about ethics after Enron. By way of introduction, I might say the following. You all know Ken Lay died earlier this week here in Aspen. There was a flurry in the media when this happened. A television interviewer came to me and said, "Is there a lesson to be learned from Ken Lay's death?" And I think the question, the idea was that I would say, yes, this was divine retribution or something along those lines. But the truth is, there is no lesson to be learned from Ken Lay's death, except that this is a man who died, and his family will suffer, as will many of his friends. And justice will in some way flow in a slightly different pattern or channel from what we initially imagined, but it will continue to flow. The consequences of Enron are still with us. And so if there is no lesson to be learned from Ken Lay's death, there is almost certainly still a lesson to be learned from Enron. And some of that lesson or pieces of that lesson or different versions of that lesson are what we're here to talk about this morning. Ethics after Enron, we've got representatives of companies that have wrestled, and I can say this based on my conversations with each of them over the past few days, the past several weeks as we've been planning this panel, have wrestled with questions that I think all of you in the audience will recognize as central to business operations in the modern world, but frankly to business operations so long as there has been business. And there has always, so far as I can tell, been business in human relations, and that's part of what we'll be focusing on. Our plan of attack this morning, I'm going to ask the panelists to address one very specific question that appeared in the write-up for this session. We'll go down the line, I think, starting at Paul's end of the table and working over to Jonathan's end. I'm going to ask a few questions leading off of the panelists' initial comments, and then about halfway through the session, I'm going to turn it over to you. And anything that's on your mind that's related to this topic, and conceivably things that aren't, but that could be worked in thanks to our panelists' imagination, that's fair game. So that's our agenda. Any questions before we start? Great. All right, so the question that I would put to our panelists as a way of getting the ball rolling, who is the conscience of the corporation? Paul?
You want to start with an easy question,
right? Let's start with a big one. We can work down to the details.
Well, the conscience, at a simplistic level, you could say the conscience of the corporation is the leadership of the corporation. But the conditions of this conscience are dictated by a bunch of realities. They're dictated by the realities of the marketplace and what customers want and demand. They're dictated by the competitive environment in which a corporation operates. They're dictated by technology. They're dictated by regulation. They're dictated by the need to attract and retain high-quality employees who can execute whatever the mission of the corporation is. So the conscience of a corporation is not some abstract idea that we write down on a piece of paper and stick on the wall. The conscience of the corporation grows out of the reality of the environment in which the corporation operates. And I would argue that corporations that are successful over a sustained period of time have understood the dimensions of their conscience, if you will, as dictated by their customers, their competitors, the technology, the regulatory environment, their employees, and they have responded to the demands on their conscience in an appropriate manner. So I'm not sure that's what you're looking for.
No, but it's certainly a start. Can you give us an example from your own experience that would illustrate this view of corporate conscience?
Well, I can tell stories which are not three. I know Lee likes stories. let me use an example that is probably familiar to many of you, and you may not define it in conscience terms, but Toyota is probably my favorite company. I spent a lot of time in the automotive industry, and I've worked with them and studied them and stuff. Toyota's defined their mission as being the very best manufacturing company in the world. They don't define themselves as being a car company, okay? And they have created a culture in their organization in which everybody understands that their primary mission in life is to manufacture the very best things that they can. Now, one way that is manifest, and I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this story, is that on the Toyota assembly lines, at virtually every workstation, there is a cord with a handle on it. It's called an Ando cord. And every worker in a Toyota assembly plant knows that if he or she sees something going on the assembly line that is not right, they not only have the authority, but they have the obligation to pull that cord and shut down the plant. Now, shutting down an assembly plant that's producing 1,000 vehicles a day is not a trivial action. And these are people at the very bottom of the totem pole. These are the assembly line workers. But they have been trained and understand that part of their responsibility in delivering on the conscience of Toyota, which is the promise to produce the very best products that they can and offer those to their customers, is to stop that assembly line if they see something that isn't right. Now, whether you would interpret that as a manifestation of the conscience of the corporation and how it's carried out in real life every day, I don't know. But I think you could make an argument that that's an example if you wanted to.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Beth?
Thank you, Lee. You asked the question of who is the conscience of the corporation. I think it is somewhat simplistic in that I think who's accountable and therefore who is the conscience of the corporation is very much the CEO. I think what we've seen over the last 5 years is that play out vividly. In the 90s, we celebrated, if you think back to all the news in the 90s, we were celebrating the imperial CEO who was more of a marketer for the organization rather than the conscience of the organization. We have seen, at Ernst & Young, we deal with clients all around the world, and I think we very much saw over the last few years, unfortunately, some of those what I would call imperial CEOs who led the conscience of the organization to a bad place, who created a culture where it was permissible to be out of bounds by their own behavior, which very much permeates an organization. If the leader demonstrates behaviorally that it's okay to be out of bounds, the organization thinks it's okay to be out of bounds, and we saw that. An example of one of our clients was HealthSouth, where we had a CEO that at the time you would have looked at it and said one of the greatest philanthropic leaders in the Birmingham community. And then once everything goes wrong, you look back and you say, should we have looked at that differently? Was that creating a conscience for that corporation that led ultimately to a massive collusive fraud? I know in our own organization, I very much see our chairman by what he says and how he behaves clearly establishes the conscience for our organization. And I just see it every day, where if he behaved differently than he talked, it would send a tremendous confusion through the organization, but he's very consistent and very much on a singular message that it is your, as an employee, it is your professional obligation to do the right thing. And that sounds so simplistic, but when he articulates it in a way where, and he articulates it just this way, if you even smell something that doesn't seem right, it is your professional obligation to get your hand in the air and say something to somebody, and don't stop until somebody listens to you. And that's not a message that was going through that our organization, 6, 7, 8 years ago. It is today, and it very much has created a conscience. Now, once you have that conscience clearly established, I think there are many, many things, and we can talk more about it, that you can do as an organization to help expose that culture, to make sure everybody in the organization feels permitted to stay within those bounds and understands the culture and the values of the organization. But I think it starts right at the top.
Great. Thanks, Beth. Sydney?
I'm not ever surprised to find myself agreeing with Beth. I'm the chairman. Conscience is no band-aid. And I say that because we live in an era where conscience has become discovered, more or less, by good numbers of senior executives. I'm obliged to do the right thing, tell me what the right thing is, have someone, if you will, at my side who will indicate to me what the wrong thing is. No executive can be the conscience of his or her company unless he, she knows, truly knows, what the hell he believes in. That's where you start. Not a set of rules, a set of personal values and convictions that you determinedly live by, not because of the law, but because whatever it is drove you, your mind, your heart, to be there. I'll tell you a story. Some years ago, a woman who worked for 27 years on a production line in one of our plants in California was savagely murdered by her former husband as she was leaving work. It was a tragedy. There is no company in the States that would not have responded in some constructive way to that awful event. Letters of condolences, a fund for the education of the children, and there's nothing wrong with that. We had a different response. We determined that we'd better damn well find out what this domestic violence stuff is about. And once we opened that Pandora's box, we were astounded. Do you know that almost one-third of all the females in this country have at some point or other in their lives been subjected to an act of such violence? We determined then to establish a program, not just in this California factory, but through the factories across this country and Europe, in which mentoring, and not by us, because we had no conceit that this was material we really were expert in, we brought in experts. We provided security. We created an environment in that plant and in all the others which encouraged people to come forward and to say to us, for the first time in my adult life, I feel free. I feel safe. What does that say of the conscience of a company to its people? And how does that get transmitted everywhere? I tell you, as I think of Enron, I have time and again been with peers, with friends, and heard them say in gatherings such as this, we're of good conscience. We run a decent company, but we're a very large company, and a few bad apples can ruin everything. We can't be everywhere. They're wrong. They cannot physically, literally, be everywhere. But by establishing that conscience, that code, that set of values, and proselytizing them, not just in conversation, but in action. I offered one example, I could offer many. That way, that chairman, that senior executive is in effect everywhere. That's the obligation of conscience.
I will come back, I hope, to the way you make that happen in an organization. Thank you, Sid. David?
Last night I had to make some remarks after General Powell and President Clinton spoke, and I thought they were hard acts to follow, but I think Sydney ain't so easy either.
There we go.
Jane, that was no charge for that straight line. I'm the chief compliance and integrity officer for a company of 200,000 people around the world. I'm the first and only person who's ever held that job. And it scares the hell out of me every single day. We are in probably 50 different cultures. We speak more than 100 different languages. We make products that go into the homes of 90% of America and a good portion of the rest of the world. And if only 0.5% of our people don't get it right, that's 1,000 people. If only 5% of our people don't understand the rules of the road, that's 10,000 people. And it is a very daunting task to think about how you manage that. I agree with what everyone said. It absolutely starts at the top. It has to be part of the fabric of the business. It must be integrated into the way people are evaluated and compensated. It's got to be part of the way the business is planned. But beyond all of that, you have to take every opportunity to try to reach the hearts and minds of your people. And that is not an easy thing when you're dealing with multiple cultures, multiple languages, multiple geographies, multiple businesses. We spend a lot of time asking our people whether they believe this stuff, both in small discussion groups and in surveys. And I can tell you what they think. They want to believe it. And I think that is the story of the modern person in a company or an organization, whether she's in Kansas City or whether he's in Taipei. But they're also skeptical. And I'll tell you what they're skeptical about. They think there are different rules for the guys and women, the few women at the top, than for the people at the bottom. They think that where the rubber hits the road, they're not sure whether the organization will choose profits over doing the right thing. And they simply have no idea how a system of governance, compliance, ethics actually works. So one of the things that we do, we run, as all the companies here do, big programs and lots of training and lots of communication and codes. And I would trade it all for the following. When a senior executive steps over the line, if he or she is not out the door the next day, everything else you've done doesn't matter, because that message is read much more clearly than any kind of program. So in the last 6 months, the senior HR executive for our corporation is gone. The senior external affairs executive for Kraft Foods is gone. And most painful to me, the chief compliance officer of Philip Morris USA is gone. All of those senior executives somehow breached the trust of the company, and they are gone. And I think that it is those sorts of things that kind of bring the reality home. The other thing we do is we tell our people what's going on. We recently told them that in a six-month period, we did 600 investigations. We found 200 violations of our code. We fired 110 people, and we turned over 7 cases to prosecutors. I think that is the kind of sort of tangible, empirical reality that you have to share with people to overcome their skepticism.
Lee, could I just add a point to that?
Yes.
Because I'm totally with David. In looking at organizations that have healthy cultures and cultures where the values are consistent with the behavior, there are two things that we look at. This is one, the way the senior executives are treated. And the other is the way bad news travels through the organization. If you find an organization where bad news travels fast from wherever it happens to wherever it needs to go, you've got a pretty good chance of having a healthy organization. If you find that news doesn't get where it needs to get or it gets filtered out somehow along the way, then you've got a problem.
But specifically to David's point, there are channels, right? And news travels through organizations unofficially, informally,
right?
And it may be accurate or less accurate, but that, I assume, is not how you would like to see that information travel.
No.
Right? So you've got mechanisms in place.
I think you need to use the formal mechanisms, and I think you need to use the informal cultural mechanisms, and both as a whole help create, sort of translate things from a conscience, which everyone's right needs to start at the top, to a consciousness that sort of permeates the whole body.
Okay, let's come back to that. Jonathan?
Well, Wow. I'm clearly the youngest and most sort of thing. This is
terrifying.
No, it's terrifying. And what's worse is I'm actually going to ask a slightly different question. And instead of saying, who is the conscience of the corporate, I'm going to say, what is the conscience of the corporate? And I think, while I've listened to everybody and I absolutely agree with what they say, I think there's one thing that we don't look at and we don't use to determine what determines our behavior. And I think the stories that we've told, and I'll try and pick out the points, emphasize what I'm saying, and that is time. Now, it's maybe a little bit eclectic and sort of left field and intellectual, but if you make an investment with the intention of being in that investment for a very long time, there is a moral obligation and compulsion to behave decently. Because, and I'm in the mining game, and we have some of the worst reputations in the world in our domain. And I would argue that if you look at the mining domain, you can actually categorize those who invest for the short term and those who invest for the long term. And those who invest for the long term are some of the leading corporates of the world. They have some of the most amazing integrated, comprehensive programs around the environment, around health, around education. And what drives that is not the regulatory environment they're operating in, it's the fact that if you're in an environment for 50 years, you can't afford to annoy your employees. You can't afford to annoy the community from which you draw your employees. You can't afford to harm the environment because then you're going to have to clean it up because you still need the environment. And in that context, I think the Toyota example is a classic one. The Hamilton, your example is absolutely right. The going about, Sydney, the looking after the people is a commitment and a belief that you're going to be there for those people for a very long time, and particularly around women's education and helping them understand interrelationship violence.
And I'm sure you'll agree, it's not just paternalism.
It's got nothing to do with paternalism. It's mm-hmm. totally economically driven. And I think in so much as you begin to use time as a lens to look at behavior, you really begin to understand what does and does not make sense. And it's interesting, I think most of the compliance problems that you would have, David, would be people who have taken a short-term opportunistic decision against the long-term benefit of the corporate. And those are the people you've had to fire, time again. And let me just, I would argue that De Beers has lived by this time maxim now for most of its life. And in many respects, I'm lucky. My great-grandfather in 1954 captured this in the most incredible way. He said, we're here to make profits, and I think everybody here accepts, and everybody in this room would accept that a company must make a profit. But then he caveated that, and he caveated it with the most powerful statement, which I use continually to determine how I behave. And that is, we're here to make profits, but in such a way as to benefit the peoples and communities within which we operate. And that was in 1954, before the human rights movement in the States. It was before unqualified franchises in many countries around the world. I mean, just think about that. And it was because we were in the business of time. We are a 118-year-old organization. Our oldest mine is older than we are. We've been in that location for 120, 130 years. We cannot afford to do damage. And it's in that context. So I've got one story. Lee, you like stories. And the reason why I've chosen this story is because in America, De Beers has a schizophrenic reputation. And I'd like to highlight one and then talk maybe about the other. De Beers' reputation is as a monopolist, which I don't believe we are, and as an exploiter. We also, in recent years, have got a reputation as a company that is truly engaged in the HIV/AIDS space, which I think is something close to everybody's hearts here. And in South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia, where we operate, we have been able to introduce holistic, comprehensive HIV/AIDS treatment programs for our employees. In Botswana, it's easy because we're in partnership with a government that is totally sympathetic and supportive. In South Africa, it's more difficult because the South African government has a number of issues around how one goes about treating HIV/AIDS. In Namibia, it's more like Botswana. It's sort of in between the two. In South Africa, we provide care to all our employees for life. We provide care to their spouses, and we're contemplating and looking at the economics of providing care to their dependents. Why do we do that? It's not for the goodness of our own hearts. It's because all our operations in South Africa have a longevity which we anticipate to be multi-generational. And in the context of that, we need to engage with our communities, support them and grow them, and enable them to survive. And we've done that so well that the world has begun to recognize De Beers's activity in this domain. And last year, we were unbelievably privileged to be awarded by the Global Business Coalition one of their 6 awards for global excellence, and that was in the context of our comprehensive program. It's, in many respects, De Beers now is held up as this HIV/AIDS champion. It's not. We have a similar process and policy and program and effort in the environment. We have similar in education. We have similar in health. It just happens that this one has been highlighted by the international community because of the focus on HIV/AIDS in South Africa. That is only possible, and it is, or rather, it is only right and proper, and it's necessary because of our long-term view. And I think that the prism of time as a alternate or left-field way of beginning to judge whether or not there's merit in moral behavior, what is the moral conscience of the company, is a very, very interesting and challenging test, and I'd love to see how this debate plays out. And I will try and refer people, if I may, to time in the context of that.
Thank you, Jonathan. So let me, for the panel as a whole, let me start with something that it seemed to me emerged more clearly from Jonathan's statement than the others, but it is implicit in much of what all 5 panelists have said, and that is, when you do the right thing, what you assess as having been the right thing or as being the right thing for De Beers employees, you argue, I think, pretty emphatically that it's enlightened self-interest. That is, it's in the business interest of the company to do these things. Does everyone on the panel agree that is why you do the right thing, why you exercise the conscience of the corporation, whether you are the vice chair for strategy or the CEO?
No, I don't. Okay. I do it because it's the right thing. And then I proselytize the right thing as a salesman. That's part of my responsibility. The things I say in gatherings like this are things I say at our annual shareholders meetings. They're things I write in our annual report. I say the right things are in themselves fully justified, but by the way, they do wonderful stuff for a business. The emphasis, as far as I'm concerned, is on doing the right thing. I feel free to say it, since probably in this entire room, by perhaps a handful of hours, I challenged Jonathan's observation about that 118-year-old mine. That's not so damn old.
You're almost that old, right?
That was my point.
I like it.
At the risk of, it's always dangerous to tackle Sydney, but let me try to. I think I would argue.
It's tough. Try him on the golf
course. Well, and I agree with Sydney. I think the stories he tells about his company and what he's done are just inspiring. But he is in somewhat of a unique position. He is the CEO of the company. His name is in the company. He's been around for a long time. Most corporate executives don't have that same set of conditions. They're in their positions for relatively short periods of time. They're not owners in any substantial way. Their time horizons have to be different because, you know, the lifespan of an average CEO today is, you know, measured in nanoseconds or something like that. So you have a different challenge in an organization where you don't have the sort of permanence of leadership that Sydney that exists in Harman International, I think. It doesn't suggest that the conditions are different, but I think this argument that Jonathan is making is that this behavior needs to be enlightened self-interest, and that's the way these executives think during the time that they are in a position to exert influence over the organization is pretty important.
But could you envision a third way so that is not either enlightened self-interest or doing the right thing because I happen to have sufficient control so that I can determine that that's what will happen? Can you be a large publicly traded corporation and still do the right thing, or do you automatically fall into the enlightened self-interest camp?
May I, at least in part, I'd like to answer it. We're an S&P 500 company. We're not a boutique. I'm responsible not just to the shareholders, but to a critical financial community.
Yep.
That doesn't necessarily bring the same point of view to this stuff that I do. Let me tell you something. I'd have a hell of a job communicating the point of view I do and making it stick if I were also explaining why we're in Chapter 7. We've got to produce the results, yep, and we do it. My argument is that one of the very best ways to produce those results is in this fashion. It's the stuff that liberates managers. It's the stuff that liberates employees. It's the stuff that generates innovation. I don't make excuses for it that we do it because we're nice guys. I say it's a hell of a way to run a business.
But in that regard, Sydney, I think what you're saying, and I'm agreeing with both you and Paul, is while it's not done because it's in enlightened self-interest, it's done, and they are mutually inclusive one of the other than the consequences in light self-interest.
Oh yeah, I don't argue that they're mutually exclusive.
I think
at all.
We're talking about nuance here. Mm-hmm. We're talking the nature of it is.
We are talking about nuance. Ain't that great?
That's great because there's fundamental agreement.
We have left one piece of this undefined, and so let me just state it, and then we still need to hear from Beth and David on this. How do you know what the right thing is? So we'll come back to that, because you were pretty emphatic about this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll come back to that in a second.
I'm emphatic about it.
And David, do you want to talk to this particular question of enlightened self-interest and the larger moral sphere that we're invoking here?
I mean, I think everybody's kind of in heated agreement.
violently agreeing.
Yeah. When you run a large organization, whether the goal is profit or some other kind of mission or both, I think you quickly realize that people have to have a larger purpose for getting up in the morning and coming to work and doing a good job. I think that compensation systems are inherently limited. I think they're great and they pay the bills and everybody needs that. But I think that when you wake up in the morning and when you're confronted with decision after decision after decision, I think people wanting to be part of something bigger and something good is much more motivating than just about anything else an organization can provide. And if organizations don't focus on what is that larger thing and how do you get people to believe in it and contribute to it, then I think you're sort of nowhere. And I think it does turn out to be enormously in the self-interest of the organization.
Yeah.
Okay. I couldn't agree more. What's the right thing? You know, everybody has to have a moral compass, and that to me guides a CEO, and that translates into the values of the organization. How that manifests in behaviors, the enlightened self-interest, is going to be different for different companies. We have different competencies. You're in the mining business. We're in the accounting business. I mean, there were different. 100%. How our enlightened self-interest actually manifests itself in the external communities in which we operate will be different because we have different competencies. I think, as David said, our employees, they're looking for a higher sense of purpose. I mean, we speak to our employees. We are providing stability in the world's capital markets. That's our role. And as the world globalizes, we have an enormous chance, and they have an enormous chance, to help lift all boats around the world to create stable capital markets and influence them. That's something our employees actually aspire to, and then creating the communities in which they live. But an employee chooses with their feet where they want to go to work, and in terms of where their interests lie and what their higher sense of purpose as human beings are, I think, takes them into different organizations and different environments, and that's the beauty of capitalism, in my mind, is you know, the employees vote with their feet into the value system they choose to sign up for. And I think I think that's an important element when you look at employees, is that you're speaking to their hearts and minds about where they've chosen to rent their competency to you for a while.
Okay.
I want to hear a wonderful story about that.
Go ahead.
It goes back to Lyndon Johnson when he was president, and he was visiting the I don't know if it was called the Kennedy Space Center then, or still called Cape Canaveral. But he was down for a launch, and he was being taken on a tour of one of the big assembly buildings. And while he was on this tour, he looked over to the side, and he saw a man standing, kind of holding a broom off to the side. And Johnson, ever the politician, went over and grabbed him with these gigantic hands he had and said, "Hi, I'm Lyndon Johnson. Who are you?" And introduced himself. And he said, "What do you do here?" And the guy looked at the president and said, "Mr. President, I'm helping to put a man on the moon." And I thought, if you have an organization where everybody in the organization thinks their job is to help put a man on the moon, you've got a swinging organization.
Right, but so that's on the positive side. Let's take your image of the moral compass for a sec, Beth. What I heard Paul saying earlier is that it's sometimes, even with a compass, pretty hard to find true north or north. I'm not sure which one the compass finds, right? So there are a lot of distractions for the individual who is expressing his or her moral compass. How do you cope with that?
See, that's where I beg to differ a little bit with Paul on your opening comments, because I felt like you were saying the moral compass could shift depending upon where the environment was at certain times and that it could move around. And I don't think it can. I think regardless of the externalities, you better be dead on your conscience, and it shouldn't falter. I think one of the things that is important, especially in a time of crisis, that gets an entire workforce through a time of crisis, is knowing exactly what that organization stands for and what the culture and the compass is.
Brings with it. You wind up. Do you have a moral compass for the organization?
A value system. I think there's a very clear value system.
But doing the right thing. I can just respond to Beth. Doing the right thing changes as the conditions change.
Yep.
Okay. If you're manufacturing in the United States with a set of well-defined rules for the way workers are treated, occupational health and safety, benefits, and all of that stuff, doing the right thing is fairly easy. If you decide to move your manufacturing to Sri Lanka or Cambodia, where the rules are totally different, you have, you know, child labor, you've got sweatshops, whatever the hell you want to call them, figuring out what the right thing to do there is much more challenging, and it's a very different context.
Very challenging, but let me give you an example. Indonesia. We've had a heck of a time in Indonesia because it's a culture of corruption. And for our business, that is an extremely dangerous place to be when we're trying to serve clients who the normal way of doing business is with some element of bribery and corruption. It makes our entire client base at risk. And we had the situation of trying to deal with our country practice in Indonesia, saying, we have to participate sort of in the corruption because that's the way business is done in Indonesia, and we won't have any clients if we don't participate in that environment. And we had to say, no, then we won't do any business in Indonesia. We will not have a client in Indonesia if that's the way things are going to be. And we've slowly now changed. We're in Indonesia, and we're serving clients who we believe are playing by the rules we think are, you know, our moral compass, if you will, and we've sort of had to impose.
So, but then, Beth, what did Ernst & Young do? Actively seek out client possibilities that you trusted would play by your rules?
Yes, and walk away from some of the marketplaces
and Beth,
that we
in
thought
the
did not.
In the context, I echo that.
Okay. Jonathan, after Sydney. Go ahead.
How does a chairman, and I want to insert here, I've had a modest epiphany here this morning, because I've often heard, well, it's okay for you to promote the point of view you do. You are, after all, the chairman. And it occurred to me for the first time this morning to ask, well, how the hell did I become the chairman? I think I became the chairman in part precisely out of the point of view and the convictions that I'm talking about today. And I'd like to see some other chairmen, and I'd like to see some other lower-level executives graduate to the chairmanship of companies precisely because they believe in this stuff and that they get to that belief by first asking themselves what it is they do believe in. You asked earlier, how do you get there? I'd suggest there are numbers of ways, and that could take a whole morning. But I wanted to support what Beth has said. No great surprise, I've been placed in that situation time and again. I don't find it difficult to say, hell no. Yeah. How in the world can I rationalize bribing a foreign official and then wonder what the heck I do if I learn that one of our purchasing agents is
done the same.
Taking a bribe. How do you establish that decency in a corporation, not by setting up rules, but by setting up examples that prompt people to think, clearly this is the way to work? There are other opportunities. You find them. When you find them, you encourage your own people and, frankly, encourage yourself to think, pretty decent way to live. In the end, nothing counts more important for an executive at any level than the development of some facility for the exercise of critical judgment. Time and again, that's what you get paid to do. How the hell do you get there other than by determining your own personal compass? And another time, I'd be happy to tell you where it seems to me that arises.
Okay, we'll come back to that, John.
I was just a question to Beth. The clients that you do have in Indonesia, are they all, what sort of businesses are they in? And, or more importantly, what kind of philosophy do they espouse that allows you to become their partner?
And variety of businesses. Go ahead.
But I guess it's in the context of time. Do they all have a long-term outlook?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it's a part of this is exercising a power of who your customers are, who you choose to do business with, has a ripple effect through an economy. And I just think that that's an important thing. Who you employ and who you do business with can have a significant impact on an economy and a culture. And our profession is one where, you know, oftentimes I want, you know, take human rights around the world. You know, if we were to, if the four major accounting firms were actually to take a position on human rights and refuse to do business with companies around the world who we, you know, but then we're really imposing standards. You know, you can get dangerous if you take this too far. But we can make a significant impact. Dealing with corruption is right in our strike zone of where we better be taking some very clear stands on who we do business with. So are they taking long-term impact, long-term horizon to your mind? Not all of them. I mean, it's all a state of, I think, moving an economy where you want it to be.
Okay. One more question before I turn this over to the audience. Paul, in your initial statement, you used the word empowerment. And the specific example of Toyota of the Ondo Accord, which effectively grants responsibility to each and every employee on the manufacturing floor. Do the rest of you want to talk in some way about that particular piece of this ethical picture, empowerment? How?
Well, I mean, again, it flows from sort of the basic values and systems through which you run the business. But I think that in almost all of these businesses, where the rubber hits the road point is whether thousands, or in our case, hundreds of thousands of people all over the place will find the courage or the support to raise their hand when they see something wrong. And what you need to do in order to produce that effect is probably the most important thing. I mean, we do all of the communications and training and proselytizing that Sydney's talking about from the CEO on down. But I can tell you that when you ask people, if you see something wrong, are you willing to come forward? And if not, why not? There is a significant minority of people that is absolutely convinced that if they come forward, they'll be retaliated against. And you've got to stand on your head from, you know, morning till night to try to sort of stamp out that belief. And everything you do can be undermined if you don't get a handle on that.
Okay. Anyone else?
We began what is widely regarded and frequently taught in the business schools, the first program in American industrial history to alter the traditional adversary relationship between employers and managers in a plant in the strange town of Bolivar, Tennessee, as retrogressive a civil society as existed ever in this country. And empowerment was central to what we were doing. I remember one time being down in that plant and talking to Paul Azure, who was the manager of one of the production lines, I found him teaching every employee on the line how to do the superintendent's job. And I asked him, in true innocence, aren't you afraid that as you teach them this work, you will lose your authority, you'll lose your power? And his, to me, deathless response was, I have found that the more power I give, the more power I got. For me, that has been something of a guide over the many, many years. You don't empower employees in a zero-sum game. As you empower them, you don't lose power. You actually gain it. It may not be the right word, but in the sense of what you're speaking about, absolutely.
But you also empower them not just to say there's a problem, but to
resolve,
yeah, find a solution, or to articulate new challenges that might then...
Some of the best innovations in our company have grown from the factory floor.
I think, if I may, Lee, from a De Beers perspective, we've had exactly the same experience. We're in the process of trying to re-engineer our culture to what internally we've come to call a green light culture, and that is things must get done unless somebody says stop, instead of a red light culture where everybody has to get permission from somebody else to do something. And that truly has been amazing. And to give you just a sense of the power, at one of our mines, the way a mine works is you take waste or non-productive earth from around, so it's an open mine, and to get to the ore body in the middle. And we have to move something like 50 million tons of waste a year at this one mine, just to contextualize. 50 million tons is not quite the size of Ajax Mountain, but it's getting there. And we use 270-ton trucks to do this. It's a monumental task. We weren't making the call that we had to make. We went to the employees, we went to the truck drivers, we had a chat to them, we described the problem, we described the challenge, we described the consequence of failing to make that waste, which was the closure of the mine in a transition from one side of the mine to the other, which will happen in about 2012. So this is something that's way out into the future. The guys got together, they came back to us with a plan. We're now doing, we took our shift waste haul from 56,000 tons a shift to 80,000 tons a shift in 12 months. That's the power of empowerment. It's incredible. And I tell you what, the people actually believe, because they believe they have a reason, they have a belief that they're going to be there through 2012. And again, I would contextualize that in time. If you don't give them the time perspective that they're going to have permanence in their employment, they won't do that. They won't make that effort. They won't make the sacrifices necessary to achieve what they have to today to ensure tomorrow.
Well, on that positive note, let me open the floor to questions from the audience. Jane?
I just wanted to ask about the corporation as world citizen, how that can motivate workers and also steer workers personally in directions that let them discover their own consciences. And the example I would give is something that did happen in the Harmon family and the Harmon company in connection with the tsunami. Cindy and I talked about how horrible it was, and our own personal reaction was that we would use some money from the small family foundation we have to help through a variety of organizations. We then also were in touch with our own children and got them to participate with us in some more means than others. But then in addition, Harmon the company learned of this gift, but I think there were many workers in the company who were personally interested. And what happened was the company matched personal employees' gifts, and the thing got quite large and interesting, and employees were given leave to go be helpful for a period of time. And not only do I think it's a nice example, but my question is, in other companies, it doesn't have to relate to the tsunami, do you think that generous responses to world crises and other acts of world citizenship are ways in which to help employees and management find a conscience?
I think it is one way, and it's a very a positive way with Katrina, with the tsunamis. The employees, they look to... I think corporations today are becoming social constructs. Global corporations are becoming bigger than a lot of country economies. And so I think employees look to the corporation as an affinity source. And so when something happens, certainly our employee workforce looks to our organization to help empower a very large response, and they can be part of that. So it really gets to their hearts and minds. In smaller ways, and we've started something we call a Social Responsibility Fellows Program, where we allow our, some of our best performers to raise their hands and say, we'd like to, we support entrepreneurship around the world. It's a big part of our business. And we allow our, some of our best performers to go to developing countries and work with entrepreneurs that we would never serve as clients. They're so small. But we let our employees go pro bono to just work with those companies for on a sabbatical, in essence, for 3 months. And what it does, I mean, it is enlightened self-interest. It creates a global mindset in that employee. It creates a sense of giving from the organization. Even if you're not one of the employees who goes, you're really proud that you're part of an organization who supports that. And we've found that to be very beneficial for people who can't go. They have families, can't go.
Let me add a quick nuance. The thing about that that program that Janie spoke about was that we deliberately determined there'd be no public relations expression of it. We rejected the invitations to appear on television and other shows and talk about it, because that kind of self-advertising begins, it seems to me, to diminish the true value of it. That's another message that somehow gets communicated through a company.
Did you send that message internally as well? That is,
in my memorandum, that was a central comment.
Now, see, that's interesting. We made the same decision, no PR around it, because we thought that was inconsistent with the effort, but we didn't talk about it internally, of why no PR, and I think we should have.
You talked about this yesterday. Maybe you could summarize yesterday's comments.
I think the idea of no PR is great. I think we've been through that culture, and Sydney, perhaps, the youngster giving maybe a little bit of advice to somebody much more senior and much more experienced. While not giving PR is great because it allows you to really focus on making sure that the investment in terms of doing good is generated and driven, focused on doing good, it can come back to bite you, and it comes back to bite you in the context of De Beers. What's our reputation as De Beers? Please, just show of hands. World monopoly and ogre and exploiter of the developing world. Come on, put your hands up.
Yeah, almost as bad as us.
Does anybody think that De Beers is a company that actually has a commitment to the communities in which it operates and really is creating wealth, prosperity, and permanence in Southern Africa or across the globe?
I'm beginning to suspect it.
And I'm looking for evidence.
Exactly. Our partner company is Anglo American, which is actually the company my great-grandfather founded. And way back when, I actually can't even remember the date, we started a huge corporate social investment effort. And we had it under the banner of Goodbye Stealth. And if you go to South Africa or you go to the countries in which we've operated, you will find, if you dig, an enormous amount that Anglo has done and that De Beers has done in creating good works. But does the world know? No. And in the context of the industry we're in, we have a rather tarnished image, which that would have done a lot to leave. And it's a question of how you find the balance. You must never, ever, ever, and here I totally agree with what everybody said, get into a position where the investment is driven by the publicity it generates. But at the same time, I think it's necessary to consciously post-facto, not after, sell what has been achieved.
I think in your position, I'd have your point of view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, I think you have to follow your own advice, which is your best ally is time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Meaning what exactly, David?
Meaning that over time,
but you have to get people
the reality emerges.
Do you have to get people to go look?
The reality emerges, or you help it emerge?
Well, I think both. But it's more that over time your actions can speak.
Just make damn sure it's a reality that
yes,
you're helping
no,
emerge.
Yes, I think we're totally agreeing on that. It has to be real. It can't be false.
David.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful, high-flow discussion, and I am the CEO of a for a long term, formerly family company, now public. And it's really gratifying to hear these things. But the one thing that's never mentioned is the elephant in the room, legislation. It seems our government, in the post-Panama period, has decided they can legislate us into moral behavior, Corporate Responsibility Act. Is that necessary? Is that a good posture for our government to take? Does that isolate us from foreign people that would like the access to our markets? I'd like to hear some thoughts about that.
Okay, here we go. David, I think you hit the nail on the head here. In terms of why was it necessary to legislate? And, I mean, everybody here, does the market system in America drive towards a short-term view or a long-term view?
Short.
If you have a short-term view, then you actually have to create structures which keep people morally sensible, hence legislation. If you had companies which were pursuing long-term strategies and clearly pursuing long-term strategies, I think Sarbanes-Oxley and the likes have had relatively less impact than companies that pursue short-term opportunism.
David, let me give you an answer that goes outside the United States, because I agree with Jonathan's comment here. But as companies become global, truly, and as they start to try to figure out how to do business in different parts of the world, Beth's example of corruption in Indonesia, labor laws or the absence of labor laws in a lot of these countries, I would argue that legislation, appropriate legislation, could be very helpful to corporations and their people in understanding what the rules are that they have to play by. Because in a lot of these environments, the question is who's making the rules and whose rules am I playing by? Am I playing by the rules of some NGO in Chicago that's dictating what my policy should be in Indonesia? Or am I playing by a set of rules that are generally accepted as the right rules in this kind of situation? Yeah. So I think legislation can be useful in some situations and counterproductive in.
I would add, David, that there really isn't anything in Sarbanes-Oxley and the legislation and the regulations that flowed out of it that represented something new to us. So those of us, and there are many of us, who have proceeded in an honorable, ethical way, should find very little, in my judgment, to fuss about in Sarbanes. I hear the fussing all the time. My peers complain all the time. It's a tax on profits. The hard reality is that, in the end, I believe much of Sarbanes has been really useful to companies. In my own case, here I claim we didn't need the darn thing. But the requirements of beefing up internal auditing, as an example, have moved us to do a far, far better job on internal auditing than we had done, and therefore than we would have done without it. So it's not altogether a bad thing.
Let me echo Sydney's comments. We get the benefit of seeing many corporations, and there is a lot of gnashing of teeth about it. But we have seen just what Sydney described, that even companies that, you know, it wasn't really necessary for, the internal control requirements in 404 and the certification requirements, the CEOs having to certify to the accuracy of their financial statements, and the cascade of that through the organization. It's not just one person sitting down and certifying. It's a cascade of various levels certifying. As an example, we had a CFO of a Fortune 50 company share with us that, you know, it used to be, before Sarbanes-Oxley, on a quarterly basis, would have all of his direct reports, the CFO, coming to him with accounting treatments or techniques to boost earnings, to just artificially, you know, proper accounting, but artificially inflate earnings. He said, no more. After 404 and 302, he said, no longer do I have to play whack-a-mole and knock down those ideas. He said, my people don't come to me anymore with them. It's created a culture. It's just helped create a cultural change that in some companies was necessary. In a lot of companies, not. But value. Most companies are getting a lot of value out of it.
I want to just add an amusing footnote to this, if I may. The requirement of Sarbanes was that the statements of a company be certified by the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer. Now, I work full-time at my company, and my title is executive chairman. I said, I want to sign. I want to certify that statement. We'll send in three signatures, the executive chairman, the CEO, and the chief financial officer. We ran into all kinds of trouble. SEC said we can't handle
three. Send it back.
They sent it back. We had to negotiate with the SEC for 6 months. Let me tell you, part of that was showboating. The showboating was my statement to our employees that was implicit in it, that A, I pay attention, and B, you can depend on it. Our statements are honest. But I found it so amusing that, God, we upset the entire bureaucracy.
So for the punchline, did you get the three signatures?
We signed all three of them.
Okay. David.
David, I think Sarbanes-Oxley can fairly be characterized as representing some of the best and some of the worst in the way we do law and legislation. I think that for the corporate sector, the certification requirements were terrific because they put the accountability where it belonged and it let companies figure out how to get there. And I think that's fine. And I think everyone would agree that if a CEO or a CFO can't certify to his or her own financials, there's a big problem. You go figure out how to organize the process within your company so that you feel comfortable doing that. I think 404 is kind of classic legislative mistake in that for a lot of companies, documenting financial controls throughout the length and breadth of worldwide operations is not necessarily the right answer to misconduct in the executive
suite.
Yeah,
certainly not going to fix it.
And so you spend a lot of money, you know, working on financial controls, and Beth and EY and PwC and others, you know, helped us do that and made a lot of money. And I think companies, including big companies, learned some stuff from that.
Yeah.
But I think that it was so expensive and so time-consuming that it probably, in some cases, caused managements and audit committees to take their eye off some of the operational issues that they should have been looking at and doing sort of mere paperwork. But I think that accountability fixing measures like certification are terrific because they say you're responsible, you're in charge, there's a penalty to be paid. Now you go figure out how to run your business.
Yeah.
I do agree with that. Can I get one follow-up?
Yes.
One of the things that I've observed is that it's changed the relationship between a company and its accountants to the detriment of the relationship.
Yeah.
In our mind, my mind, you know, my accountants, which in those days were Deloitte and now it's somebody else, doesn't matter, were important confidence, repositories of knowledge about our company, about the rules, to help us to follow these rules. Not at the end. Because if we're not able to perform everything on our own, they'll write up the material that weakness led to us. But you never had one.
Now switch to E&Y.
Well, we can't get advice from them. We can't consult with them on issues. We have to go someplace else. I think that's corrosive. I think we've lost something that was valuable. Certification, we do the best we can to know what we're supposed to know, and then we close our eyes and pull our nose and sign it. You know, that's what we do. We do the best we can to know about it.
David, I think what's interesting is that there were already some international precedents. In the UK, there's Cadbury. For us in South Africa, we got King One and King Two, which are pretty close to Cadbury. And in many respects, what they have...
Cadbury, King One, and King Two, nothing.
Their report's similar to Sarbanes-Oxley and requirements to comply. What they don't demand as extensively as Sarbanes-Oxley is the paper trail. Right. Mm-hmm. But what they do demand is the accountability.
Mm-hmm. But let me be clear. The legislation was fine. The regulation and the implementation of the regulation is where things got askew. And it's what caused, and let me, one more factor is our litigation environment that we face today is, I think, really a serious problem for the U.S. economy. And it's not just for the accountants, it's for corporations in general. There is an overhang with the implementation of the regulation under Sarbanes-Oxley, to which everybody went to the extreme. In terms of, and I think it'll come back. There will be some shift back, but the litigation system that overhangs our system is a serious concern.
We might come back late in the hour to this question. So law compliance and what goes beyond law and compliance, just as a placeholder. Pete, and then the gentleman in the white shirt on the left.
Yeah, hi. I work with your raw material. I teach in the business school at Berkeley. And what I'd like to ask the panel is a question. You had 2 minutes to say to my raw material that is coming to your company or may not come to your company, why be ethical? Now, I understand all the systems you have in place to ensure ethical behavior. I understand completely the modeling of the CEO and the chairman and so on, and to take out the worst offenders at the top first. I totally agree with that. But the raw material is sitting there in front of me being skeptical about, I understand the negative side of bad ethical behavior, but tell me, why should I be ethical? So if you could just have 2 minutes this skeptical crowd of 28 to 30-year-old MBA candidates, what would you say?
I would say that you have no greater responsibility to yourself than your personal development. Being ethical is an aspect of it. Knowing is another aspect of it. Deriving that material we think of as wisdom is another aspect of it. You come to business school because you want to prosper. Developing that personal compass is one of the guarantees of it. Not absolute guarantee, but closer than anything else this business school can give you. There's an old joke about a kid asking his dad, who owns one of those ubiquitous candy stores that used to appear on the corner of every block in Manhattan, "Dad, what's ethics?" "Good thing you asked," the old man said. "Fellow came in here this morning to buy a cigar, a dollar cigar. By mistake, he gave me a $10 bill. And then he left. Ethics, my son, is, should I tell my partner?"
If I had that 2 minutes, I would say that business is the ultimate sort of institution in society that needs to face reality. Every day, if people aren't coming out and, you know, plunking down their hard-earned dollars for your product, you're going to lose. And I think in business, the best people face reality and tell the truth. And that over the long haul, you will be appreciated in an organization as one of those people who tells the truth, because it's not everybody. And I think many, many, many careers are made by people who are willing to stand up and call reality as they see it and tell the truth. And I think that that's something that people don't get about what senior management needs. You know, most people in senior management wouldn't give you a nickel for all the people who kiss their ass, but they would give you a lot for the people who come up and say, you know, respectfully, you've just blown it, and let me tell you why, and let me tell you a better way. So that's what I'd say.
Absolutely. I would give you a much shorter and somewhat glib appearing answer, but one that I happen to believe. I'd tell your students to go home and ask their mothers that same question.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd listen to those answers pretty carefully.
And my shorthand would be civil society depends on it.
And by the way, if I could have a dream, I'd teach your class. And the dream would be not that I would answer, why should you be ethical, but that they would derive from all of the conversations and everything that went on in the class that the best idea that they personally generated out of the class is that being ethical pays off.
And perhaps
it pays off
in every way.
And perhaps I could just finally bring in maybe a foreign view. And that would be working in a developing world where everything is more extreme. Ethics result in the benefit of individuals, the benefits of corporates, the benefits of those who work in the corporates. And what is particularly interesting is to look at the length of career that you have in companies that behave ethically versus the length of career you have in companies that don't, and the job satisfaction that you derive in companies that behave ethically, and the job satisfaction that you derive in companies that don't, rather than the financial satisfaction thereof.
My name is Larry Gelman, and I don't run a company, but I invest in companies for myself and my clients. And to look at the Enron part of the title of this, session, it would seem as though the problem that was created at Enron was very heavily linked to the fact that everyone in the company seemed to have their financial future linked to the stock going up on a continuous basis. And here we are several years later, and we're still in a situation where many companies, stock options and stock-based compensations far exceed, for many of the top management people, their cash compensation. And it would seem as though that would create enormous pressure, and for people, you know, who don't have necessarily a long-term view, to produce continuous short-term results. So I guess my question is that, in view of what happened at Enron and the price that society and a lot of individuals paid for it, have we made enough adjustments to the system to keep it from happening again and to protect against the human nature response, really, to this whole form of compensation and the way we really have set up many of our companies?
Well, I think one of the things that works, by the way, I essentially agree with the premise of what you had to say. Options have been corrupted, and in the process have corrupted many of the people, and Enron is perhaps the classic example. The determination by numbers of companies, without this being a requirement, as long as 6 years ago when we did it, to expense options was a good constructive step. Today, it is required. We heard, and I used to debate this with the ranking member on the Intelligence Committee, we heard that the expensing of options would destroy Silicon Valley. It has had no such effect. I believe that one of the other consequences, not just of Enron, but of the distortions that develop in any one of these systems, in this case for compensation, is that numbers of companies have vigorously scaled back, modulated the programs, because the purpose of it was to make certain that the executives who received those options were committing their careers, in effect, to that company. It's a work still in process.
It is a work still in process. I think, you know, your question was, could it happen again? Have we really changed anything? And the answer to that in the compensation area is no.
I think, though, that the one sort of more optimistic view of the results of all this is that it so clearly has heightened the sensitivity about the things that can go wrong and encouraged companies to talk to their people about risk and about the fact that even if you don't want to do it right because it's the right thing to do, you know, there are prosecutors who are just waiting for companies, big companies, particularly big companies in the news, to make a mistake. And I think that is having some healthy effect. It's not necessarily the way you'd always want it to happen, but it is a reality, and it's a reality that we can take advantage of in terms of heightening people's awareness and sensitivity to risk.
But that's why, as a CEO or as an investor, you know, I would care so much about the consciousness of the company that I'm investing in, the quality and the value system of that CEO, and what kind of culture it's created. I think that is so critically important.
Although measuring that is just the tough part.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
As a point of privilege. Not get any help from the analysts in that area.
No.
When you read the reports and try to find research and find out more about companies, there's nothing about what kind of corporate citizens they are. It's all about whether they're going to earn a penny more or less this quarter.
And
so
that's why you should publicize that you give to Katrina.
I agree. So that it's visible of what you care about.
We have a question. I think this will be the last question in the back, sir.
Honesty and ethics when your company has a great
cigarettes.
Yeah, it's amazing we got an hour and 15 minutes in before that came. I mean, I think that the way we approach it is to ask ourselves and ask people all over the world, what's it mean to be a responsible manufacturer of this product, and to try to take leadership in that. I don't know if you saw the New York Times Magazine of 2 weeks ago, but the cover story was essentially about our role in pushing for FDA regulation of tobacco. And not only have we done that in this country, and we're the only company to do it, we've done it all over the world. So the question is there a responsible way to be a manufacturer of this product? And what is that way? And I think that is the only way to be in this business or any other business. Yeah. I think to a lot of people, that is not an adequate response. And I guess I say to those people, who do you want to leave this business to? Do you want to leave this business to the Chinese monopoly, who really does not care about any of the things I just said? Or do you want to leave it to companies like Philip Morris USA and Philip Morris International, who have learned, not because they were born ethical or wanting to do the right thing necessarily, but learned through hard experience what the world expects from them? And so far, it appears no society in the world has chosen what is, you know, a choice, which is to just ban the stuff. And, you know, I actually, as a person, don't really have a problem with society making that choice. But it seems like societies both here and all over the world have kind of implicitly balanced that and decided, no, that's not the choice we want to make. So then the question is, how do you operate the business? And I think that if you dig into our two companies, Philip Morris USA and Philip Morris International, you'll see enormous leadership at the expense of profits in many cases for the long term, thinking that there is a reasonable and responsible way to do this. And I recognize that to a significant number of people out there, that is not an adequate response, but that is the best I can do and we can do.
Could I just go ahead, Sydney?
Point of privilege to the ancient.
Young at heart.
I think the essence of this discussion suggests that those of us who are in business and have executive roles have to somehow find appropriate equilibrium between the mind and the heart. Here's a bit of poetry, 3,500 years old, take 30 seconds, but it's lovely. This is from the Chinese philosopher Mencius, who said that the men of old, wishing to clarify and diffuse throughout the empire that light which comes from looking straight into the heart and acting, first set up good government in their own states. Desiring good government in their own states, they first organized their families. Eager to organize their families, they first disciplined themselves, and determined to discipline themselves, they first rectified their hearts.
Nice job, Dan. Do we need to go someplace from there?
Sydney's a perfect closer.
On that note, then, thank you, panelists, all.